guys, it's not.
No, we're not.
No, seriously, you're totally elitist. You feel like the unappreciated scholars, so you shit on the people who know less than you.
No.
Which is everybody.
Yeah. Yes.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Dome and Bedlam, the official Lookout Landing podcast. My name is Nathan Bishop. I am the managing editor of Lookout Landing. I'm joined today by Scott Weber. Scott, how are you today?
I'm excellent. Just conquered Canada. Did the whole thing today.
That's not a really difficult achievement, but good for you anyway. We have a special guest joining us today. We have Seattle Times beat writer. Guy's been with the following the team around for years on and off. Ryan Divish is with us. Ryan, thanks so much for joining us, man.
No problem. Which one's Dome and which one's Bedlam?
You know, that's a good question. We usually have a third guy with us, David Skiba, and he's kind of a combination of both.
I'd say okay. He's the and.
Okay.
In that equation.
I'm probably more Bedlam than Scott is.
Sure, I'll take Dome.
That's fine. That's fine. Ryan, I heard, I'm a little disappointed that we didn't get the scoop on this one, but I heard on about an hour ago on another show you were on saying that Felix no longer has the cornrows. Is that accurate?
Yes, he has them out. Instead, he has a mini man bun on his head.
Is this?
As I said before, his hairstyles are largely based on dares or bets that he's not telling us about. I feel like they have this little basketball court and they have the pool table and all this stuff. I feel like he's been playing Wade Miley in some of these clubhouse Olympics before he got hurt and is losing these bets. And like Wade Miley's like, all right, man, why don't you put your hair in cornrows and why don't you blonde your hair? And then like Miley probably lost the other day and they said, hey, why don't you shave your beard off for all of us to see what your face actually looks like? And then once he did that, they probably said, okay, put it back on quickly.
We've heard Felix and Wade are pretty close, right?
Yeah, it's a really odd relationship. A guy from Bayou Country, Louisiana, and a guy from Venezuela seem to have found a mutual bond over food and a language that they speak unto themselves.
And horrendous hair.
Oh God, yes.
It's the worst. I hope Felix knows how much this is killing us. It's like a year long ultimate troll job.
Yeah, and
I
don't think
he won one bet.
It.
We know he won one bet because there was no beads in it. Instead.
Yes.
So at least there was a double down opportunity and he won that one.
That's got
I don't see him. I don't see him changing it anytime soon. He's pretty stubborn about that. And he said he was going to keep it all year. I've never known him to lie about something like that.
Speaking of him telling the truth, how's he moving around?
He's okay. He's got this big boot on his foot and he's not happy about it, but apparently he was walking so awkwardly with the strained calf that it made the inside of his calf start hurting as well. So I don't know. Maybe they should just lock him in one of those protective cases for a while and not let him do anything. But yeah, he doesn't handle sitting out well, not being a part of stuff. You know, he has FOMO, fear of missing out. I'm sure when he was at home and not able to go on the road trip, that bothered him. But yeah, he has not handled this well. He gets very irritated talking about being on the DL and not being able to be a part of it.
What fun for you.
Something. Yeah.
Scott, what do you have for Ryan today?
Speaking of guys on the DL, dude, where's Charlie Furbush? I mean, really, no one is talking about him at all, and that probably means he's donezo, right?
I have no idea what his deal is now. I've heard a lot of different reports. You know, nothing that's been corroborated by the Mariners, but every time he gets back to that point, where you think he's going to, you know, start throwing in real games, it just doesn't bounce back. The shoulder never bounces back. Now, I don't know if that means that the tear in his rotator cuff is to the point where it just is going to be that way, or, you know, because, I mean, rotator cuff surgery isn't something you really want to go down that road. As somebody who's got a torn rotator cuff right now, you know, even my doctor said, and I don't throw for a living, that you want to be very careful because when you come back from that, it's not the same. And I think that's what Charlie Furbush is kind of afraid of right now. And I don't know that that's needed. I've heard conflicting people tell me that, and some of them have all of the knowledge of Andy Van Slyke in this situation, which is none. So, you know, I just think he's still here. He hasn't gone to Arizona to do his spring training thing. To think that he's even going to be around by the All-Star break is I wouldn't even bet on that.
Yeah, we've just started, you know, when we had that whole, like, massive bullpen injury platoon there at the beginning of the year, we were kind of talking, you know, Furbush and Zick and Benoit are all going to come back. We just kind of stopped mentioning Charlie because it's just, we have no idea. Yeah. It just feels like it's going to be impossible. Hey, I wanted to ask you about James Paxton. Because
good segue.
Yeah.
Right there for guys that don't bounce back quickly from injury.
Right. Yeah. Right. Fragile guys. I mean, we have no idea. It still feels really fragile with him two starts in. But have you talked to him about – I mean, even in the minor leagues, I've talked to people. He was not – the velocity was not what we've seen in his two starts in the major leagues down at Tacoma. Has he made a change that he's talked to you about since he's been back up, or is this just kind of adrenaline, or is something clicked with him? Do you know?
Well, yeah, it's an arm slot issue that he fixed. He seemed to have gotten really over the top and very deliberate with his path to the plate, and it just looked awkward. I mean, look, James is never going to look athletic a day in his life, but it looked really awkward. And so they decided to – I don't know if it was – yeah, it was Lance Painter down at AAA. They hit him a ground ball to the mound and said, throw it to first. And he just picked it up, which – you know, with James and his PFP ability, actually fielding the ground ball and throwing to first is pretty good for him. But, you know, he threw to first and Painter said, that's your arm slot, your natural throwing arm slot. And basically, you know, I don't know if he was trying to get downward angle or just trying to, I don't know, maybe it's from trying to protect something, you know, because he's had so many different injuries, but it just had gotten out of whack and it wasn't a free and easy kind of motion. It was really mechanical. And that sapped a lot of his velocity. And so this is, you know, he lowered the arm slot, the release point a little bit. I wouldn't say it's three quarters by any means, but it's just not so definitively over the top. And he kind of admitted that this was kind of how he threw maybe in double A, and it felt more natural. So this is more of a natural arm slot. He's throwing that angle, and, you know, good things have happened. I think everybody talks about the fastball velocity kicking up to triple digits, which is big, but I think also it's made that little cutter that he throws more of a slider type movement, which is big for him because he's got the kind of weird, nasty overhand knuckle curveball, but having that slider to go side to side a little bit changes another eye level for the hitter as well.
Sure, and it seemed like in that second start too, he was really hitting his spots a lot better and getting the command under control too, because now, like you said, with the cutter, he's got a little more movement into the right-handed hitters. Or at least in the breaking pitches. So that first start, it definitely seemed like he was just hanging stuff over the middle of the plate.
Yeah, I agree. I thought he was nervous in the first start. I thought he was trying to find his way. And you know, and you can't pitch like that at the big league level. You can't pitch afraid. And I think that's what he was doing a little bit because, you know, he hasn't had a ton of success in the last year and a half. And so to come back in and pitch kind of in a passive manner just isn't going to work. And they really pushed for him not to do that. You know, they got on him about establishing the inner half. I mean, when you're throwing 99 and you've got kind of some natural movement at that angle, if you can't get in on a right-hander's hands and break some bats, I mean, that's what you got to do. And I think he did that. I mean, it's been romanticized a little bit more than I think about pitching with an edge and stuff like that. You know, a lot of times it's easy to pitch with an edge when you've had success, but when everything's going wrong and you can't figure out what the hell's to do about it, it's hard to have an edge. And I think, you know, that they wanted him to just be more aggressive. It's not about going out, you know, pounding your glove or whatever. He's the nice Canadian kid. I mean, it's not his thing. He's not going to be your Donald Ventura. But go out there and establish the inner half, pitch hard, throw inside, you know, be aggressive. And don't nibble when you throw 99. You know, don't put yourself in a position where they know the fastball's always coming. And I think that was the bigger thing, more than just, you know, always, you know, pitching angry or anything like that.
Yeah, he let it out a little bit at the end of that start, though. You know, it was good to see. I had seen that from him before.
He's got one of the best, driest senses of humor on the team. He's really funny. And, you know, he's very aware. And I think there is some emotion there, but like I said, it's hard to be emotional when you don't feel like anything's going right.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I think that's the big thing is like, and I don't want to say he was panicking, but you know, you can't be all Felix if you're throwing like Peralta. You know? I mean, that's just how it is.
Yeah. Hey, speaking of reclamation projects, and this organization has been full of them. It's been one of the big stories of the DePoto regime. Are you hearing anything? I mean, I don't have any reason to be particularly displeased with Chris Iannetta. I would imagine the team's really happy with him. Are you still under the impression that, you know, Mike Zunino's down in AAA for all intents and purposes for the rest of this year? We get this question a lot. I'm sure you do, too.
Yeah, I don't think they're in any rush to bring Mike back because they want it to be real. Now, if Steve Clevenger or Iannetta got hurt, yeah, Mike would come back.
Yeah.
But they want to see sustained success. I mean, if you go look at the month-by-month numbers, after that hot start for Zunino, there was a period where I think he hit 180, and the strikeout numbers went up and the walks went down. You know, and that's going to happen as he goes through the course of a season. And I think the bigger issue is they want to you know, make sure that whatever he's doing out there in Tacoma is real enough that when he gets up to the big league level and results really matter, that he doesn't revert to anything that he used to do.
Right.
And I think that's the biggest thing. You know, it's all well and good. And I mean, they know what Iannetta is or isn't. And, you know, he's not going to hit 260. But if they can get 240 or 230 out of him and it's starting to climb back up there again, and if he just gets on base and puts together a bat, they'll take that. I think, you know, people have talked about his throwing percentage and stuff, and it hasn't been good. He's never been known to be a great throwing catcher. He's been known to be pretty adequate. But I think the Mariners are one of the worst teams in baseball at holding runners on base. I mean, they are. Nathan Carnes is so slow to home, and he gets into patterns.
Yeah.
Felix is not very good at holding runners. Iwakuma is slow. Yeah. You know, Walker's one of the better ones. And then Paxton, also, for a lefty, doesn't have a great move at all.
No, Miley's okay. I mean, you could,
yeah, and Cishek's not good at holding runners on. And Benoit, I think he uses the philosophy of putting them to sleep first before he throws. But, you know, they don't have a great team at holding runners on. I mean, it's not as bad as having Wilhelmsen, who was abysmal, but it's still not great. And I think that's affected Iannetta defensively as well.
Yeah, it's been funny to see people kind of be critical of Iannetta and point to Zunino's AAA numbers. And I'd agree that overall the Chris Iannetta package is pretty adequate. And if you as a Mariner fan can't appreciate adequate from the catcher position after last year, I just don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, it's as if they've forgotten how bad it was last year.
Yeah.
Where those were automatic outs. Even in Iannetta's slumping period, those weren't all just nasty strikeouts, three-pitch strikeouts. The ball was being put in play. He might not have been hitting the ball very hard, but he was doing something. He was still trying to work a count.
Yeah. Scott, do you have a follow-up on Zunino?
Yeah, Ryan, I was just curious. I mean, I know last year Edgar and Zunino really were working together a lot and through spring training as well. Do you know if those two are still kind of in contact or how the whole process has gone into that tutelage while Mike is down in AAA?
Yeah, I think they are. I mean, they have reports. The one thing that's helped is this kind of overall hitting philosophy that they all preach. You know, they had the hitting summit that Mike was a part of, and Scott Brosius, the AAA manager, was there, or the AAA hitting coach was there. And so they kind of have an overall idea of what is expected. And specifically with Mike, you know, Edgar and Brosius were together all spring working with him as well. Mm-hmm. So they have a handle of what is working for Mike and what isn't. And I've got a lot of good reports back from Brosius on that because he just is a good listener. He doesn't try and overwhelm you with information. He tries to take little pieces and help you and keep you comfortable. Because I think that was the one thing last year. Zunino's talked about it, but these weren't like minimal changes. These were wholesale changes to a guy. And it really messed with them. And the same thing happened with Michael Saunders, and the same thing happened with Dustin Ackley. Maybe they weren't from Mariners coaches, they were from outside coaches. But when you get into drastic changes for these guys, it's usually not a good thing because it takes so much time to ingrain them into their muscle memory that it never results into what they think is actually going
to
happen.
And Mike's kind of the personality type where he kind of wants to value everyone's input, right? He doesn't want to make anybody feel like he's poo-pooing what they're going to say to him.
No, he's probably one of the nicest kids I've ever covered.
Yeah.
He's the ultimate coach's kid, or, you know, baseball kid. His dad was a scout. There's a funny story they told me when he was like in maybe T-ball or first year of coach pitch. He's out there and he's catching, and and they're doing some stuff. They play catch, and they're all hitting, and they're taking turns. And he says to the coach, he goes, "So, coach, when are we going to take an infield outfield?" I mean, that's what he was at, like, age eight.
So. Well, yeah, I mean, we're definitely rooting for him. I wanted to ask you, we get a lot. I mean, I think we have a lot of crossover, Ryan, in the feedback that we get from people on Twitter and comments mm-hmm. on what we write and stuff. And I'm sure that you've noticed that one of the big stories, not trying to make a pun there, has been Deho Lee so far this year. And yeah. And one of the questions that I've gotten serious questions and I've got silly questions. One of the serious questions that I got was if you know if the team has talked about his role beyond this year at all. I don't think that seems very likely for a 33-year-old guy kind of living out his dream this year, but you haven't heard anything about that, right?
No, not that I know of. I mean, yeah. I think this was a one-year flyer, and they'll see. I mean, you know, they certainly aren't going to make a commitment because I still don't think they know completely who Deho is as a major league player. Right. You know, he's had a lot of success. I still don't believe, I can't believe, and we saw it last night a little bit more. I would never throw him fastballs and fastball counts. I would pitch him backwards
yeah.
the way in Japan because he has a knack for finding ways to get into fastball counts. And you see that leg kick go up and he's going to try and jack something out.
Yep.
Now mm-hmm. he's done a nice job of punching stuff through the right side,
yeah.
but I would stay off speed and see, look, you know, maybe he hits a single
mm-hmm.
and that's all well and good. But if he hits a single, he's I-5 traffic. On the bases, you know? And instead of giving him a fastball and a fastball count and let him try and jack something out, if I was an opponent, I'd just say, all right, here's breaking stuff. You can beat it. You know, we'll give you singles all day, especially with nobody on because we don't really worry about you as a base runner. That was what's crazy about last night on the Lindor play where he hesitated.
I know.
And Kipnis didn't cover. One, Lindor probably could have ran the second
right.
and tagged it. Or Kipnis could have foot raced him with a broken leg and still probably beat him to second base. And neither happened. And it changed the whole outcome of the game.
I thought maybe – I couldn't tell. I was at the game last night, but I was out on the center field rail. It almost looked like Deho may have almost like a solar eclipse, like gotten in the way between Kipnis, and he literally couldn't see the play in front of him. Because Deho is
– maybe.
He is – I mean, he's not just, you know, like a rounder guy. He's a massive guy.
Yeah, he's like 6'6 or 6'5. Yeah, I mean, he's a big human being.
Yeah, he's very – is he Juan Thomas large?
Well, yeah, but Juan Thomas – I mean, Juan Thomas had a pretty good-sized tummy on him, but Deho's Deho's moving and jiggling in some parts that you probably don't
want to
see.
He is as soft a body as I remember seeing in Major League Baseball for a position player in a long time. It's pretty.
I was just that just made me think about Luis Antonio Jimenez.
Oh, big right sloppy. There. Big sloppy, as they call him.
That was big boy, too.
Yeah, big yeah. guys. Scott, what else do you have?
Yeah, I'm kind of interested to get your take on what is going on with middle infield up and down the organization. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that what we've seen this year, that Chris Taylor's future in this organization is sketchy at best. I mean, coming up and having critical errors and then going back down. Do you have any idea like what the confidence level is like for him and like really what he might think of how the organization views him right now? Because it's pretty clear that he's the third shortstop in the pecking order right now. Is he even a trade asset at this point? How much value has he lost?
Yeah, it's weird. Chris is kind of in purgatory right now as a prospect. You know, when he got sent down, it wasn't for the errors, though the errors didn't help.
Right.
But they had backed themselves into a corner when they had sent Sardinas out, and they really had hoped not to put Marte on the DL. And so they had to make a roster move to get a guy, or they had to get a guy there in case, you know, because they could have played roster bingo and moved O'Malley out or something like that and had a guy. But, you know, then Taylor made theirs. I have not seen that guy play with any sort of confidence at the big league level
yeah.
in quite a while. And this goes back to spring training when he was competing for a job. And you know, it's crazy to think about this, but he was winning that shortstop battle with Brad Miller
yeah.
last
yeah.
spring.
Before he got
and
yep.
he broke his hand.
Yep.
And it was that Jim Anderson or whatever, the guy from the Brewers, or Jim Henderson. He broke his hand, and then, you know, he came back, and he had to go to AAA, and all that's well and good. But had he not broken his hand, I think he would have broke camp with the Mariners, and they would have began that process of converting Brad to an outfielder mm-hmm. earlier, like right there. They would have started doing that right then and there. Mm-hmm. And then that didn't happen, and I don't know. I mean, like, this spring, he made a ton of errors. He looked tentative, and a lot of it, he admitted, was on the swing changes, and he was trying to do a lot of different stuff. You know, you're trying to implement that while you're competing, and that isn't always the best scenario. But he just came up and just we've never seen him play kind of loose and free. Like I'm sure you've seen him play in Tacoma.
Yeah, he's different guy.
Great down there. Yep. Different guy. And yep. I don't know if he's got white line fever or what, but I wouldn't like sit there and say the time has passed, but Ketel Marte is the everyday shortstop of this team going forward.
Yeah.
And that's not going to change. So where Chris is now, I don't know, but you know, how much value is an opposing team in a trade situation going to have based only on AAA numbers when they've seen how bad the MLB numbers are? It's hard to say.
Yeah.
Yep. I think that's one thing that's encouraging about Mike Zunino. That's not maybe Chris Taylor's there too. I call it the Brandon Wood syndrome, where guys come up and there's mashing in the minors, and then they get to the majors and they fail over and over again. And then eventually mm-hmm. they're in the prime of their careers and they get back to the minors and they just can't do it. So mm-hmm. it's nice that I guess the storybook isn't closed totally yet, but I'm with you. He does not look like he has any confidence at this level.
No, and I think if maybe he gets some of it, you know, you'll see some results. But then again, what is the ceiling of Chris Taylor versus the ceiling of Ketel Marte?
Yeah, it's just
I think Marte being a speed guy and switch hitter, you know, it's not even a power guy, but he's a better guy.
Better athlete.
Better athlete. It just gives Easily. You more.
Yeah.
He does more for you in a game than Chris Taylor can right now. Agreed. And maybe Taylor is a utility guy that at best. I mean, maybe he is eventually going to be a Willie Bloomquist type, but Ooh. It's hard to see him being more than that.
Yeah, it might actually be, I think it's an overused cliche in sports, but a change of scenery might actually be the best thing for him. I mean.
Oh, yeah, I know. I mean, like him or look at Stefan Romero. I mean, he was blocked last year. He was blocked last year for Ricky Weeks and all these other guys. And you know, he was beat up. You know, and if you look at the spring he had this year, he probably wins a job on a lot of teams. But I've talked to some scouts that really think he can hit, that he's just not in a situation where you can put him out there for 300, 350 at bats and 400 bats and see what he does. I think, you know, in a different situation a year ago, maybe he gets those at bats, but they didn't have that kind of luxury.
Yeah.
And so maybe that's what's going to happen with him, because I think he can hit a little bit. I don't know that he's an everyday, you know, high level player, but I think he can hit a little bit. You don't put up the kind of numbers he put up at AAA, and they're not, you know, he didn't have the swing issues that Montero had,
right?
You know, where he just lunched on 91 mile per hour fastballs. Montero's doing it, or Romero's doing it a little differently, and I think he can play a little bit.
Do you have time for a couple more, Ryan?
Sure.
Okay, cool. I was curious because you posted a Twitter video last Thursday during that 12-2 crazy comeback of you just copying selecting all on your computer for your gamer and then just hitting delete. Do you actually do that? Like, will you go through and have like 500, 600, 700 words and just delete the entire thing for a rewrite if you have to do that?
Yeah, Fernando Rodney made me do that several times. Because it wasn't just that they would lose or be. I mean, he would change the entire story of a game.
Right.
Like when I think of a game story and how I start it, a lot of times, you know, one of my old editors said, I used to think you're writing for people who weren't there. He's like, no, you're writing for people who were there, but then maybe don't understand all that happened that they saw. You want to give them more information as to what they saw in the game, the background of the why. And also, like, what I usually lead with is if I'm walking into a sports bar post-game and people ask me, so what happened? What do I tell them first? You know, and that's kind of how I do that. Well, Fernando Rodney made every story, you know, about him a lot of ways, you know, even when he would save the game. So, yeah, I've counted, I make me nauseous to think how many words that I've had to delete because something happened in the ninth inning. You know, it's never been quite the extreme where I've had to delete like a whole story like I did the other day. But I mean, everything I had written at that point was all about how bad Wade Miley had been and everything else and how they were limping into Texas for this huge series. And then, he had to totally delete because it was like historically something changing. But I had to write the running game story for the Super Bowl in Arizona for our webpage. And I had like 5 different Word documents with different leads because I had one all about the Seahawks going back to back and all that's going to be. And I had one about leading with Jermaine Curse's catch.
Miracle catch.
yeah, leading, you know, going off the NFC title game where he caught the ball. And then I got to write about an interception that I did not see coming. Oh, my God. There were so many mistakes. And then I had angry 12 just screaming at me because I messed something up. I was like, oh, I that's why I never want to do football again.
We're much more passive in baseball. It's like, nah, all right, there's another game tomorrow.
It's not football level, but we get our fair share of loons on Twitter.
Yeah, there's
plenty. Oh, no. And then that's – I mean, look, and that's the thing. And I blow some guys up, and I admit it. But, like, as I tell people one time, like, if you're going to be a dick to me on Twitter, I'm going to fire back. And don't be mad if I'm better at it than you. It's kind of my default personality at times. So, you know, but I respect, like, and that's one thing I've tried to do. Like, you know, I'm different than my predecessor at the Times. I don't believe in telling you what I think the team should do or how I would do it or anything like that. I'm there to provide information for you. I'm not going to tell you how to be. Tell you how to be a fan. Sure. That's the one thing I hate doing. I had some guys at TNT tell me this and teach me. Don't tell fans how to think.
Yeah.
Provide them the information to let them think for themselves. You know, am I going to always agree with you? You know, just because I'm not going to agree with what you think, but that's kind of how I do it. I don't try and force my way of thinking on everybody. You know, it's like the bunting thing. I don't believe in bunting very much. I mean, I played in college. I hated when I had to bunt.
Yeah.
But there are times when it should happen, and there are times when it shouldn't. You know?
Yeah. I try to – we're in a little bit different situation since we're kind of a fan site anyway. So, like, our perspective on it is a little bit more fans. But, yeah, when people come at me on Twitter all the time. The thing that I can never get over, and you get this all the time with your infamous people yelling at you about the lineup. But, you know, if the team loses 3 or 4 games in a row, people come and yell at me like I lost three or four times. And that's the thing that I could never get over. The idea that because I cover the team, I'm responsible for their play.
And yeah, you take less of a grandstanding stance than I ever did, too. So
yeah.
I got it 10 times worse.
What I find odd is that it's like you get some fans that say, you need to go in there and, you know, blow this guy up or confront this guy or that. And like I tell them a lot of times, one, they're not under oath.
Right.
You know, they're not under oath. They don't have to, you know, if you don't like, I try and tell them, look, the question's being asked. You just don't like the answers that are being given.
Right.
You know, but we don't do it in a confrontational tone. This isn't First Take. You know, this isn't Fox News or MSNBC. It's not a yelling contest. We go in there and you ask the questions. You ask them to provide information. You may have a follow-up saying, well, can you clarify? Like, I'm not certain what you meant. But, I mean, I'm not going to go in there and say, well, why did you pull this guy now? I wouldn't have. You know, it's not that. I mean, are there ways that fans influence stuff we ask? Of course.
Yeah.
You know, like I'll say, look, there's a lot of people wondering what's going on. Why did you do this? You know, a lot of people would say, why wouldn't you do this? But we can't sit there and really force, you know, it's just not an interrogation. I'm not going in there throwing fastballs at a guy's head and you know, seeing if they'll never talk to me again after this, because I got to do a job on a daily basis. And it's not like I'm afraid to ask somebody that something's going to piss them off. I do that even without trying most times, but it's like, it's this whole thing, like, you got to go in and hold them accountable. Well, how do you do that? I mean, this whole idea,
I love that
accountability
idea
on that thing on Twitter, this whole meme of you got to hold them accountable. What the hell? What is that? What is the definition of being held accountable? They stand up and just say, yeah, I screwed up. What do you do beyond that?
Yeah.
I mean, screw up. And can you flog me 12 times with a whip, or can you just, you know, take me out back and kick the crap out of me? No, I mean, there's not much more you can do. I mean, what are they going to do? Fire themselves? Say, look, take me out of the lineup. You know, it's a weird dynamic that we're in, but that's part of social media, that everybody has a voice and everybody can be reactionary to the situation. And not that I'm any great sociologist or psychologist, but I've usually come to realize that the emotional reactions to situations usually aren't the best, well thought out plan.
No.
Right.
No.
And especially because you gain insight sometimes after the game that would negate reactionary reactions, right? Like, why wasn't this guy pinch hit for or something like that? And it's like, well, he had bad chicken wings before the game and he was,
yeah,
you know, he was shitting his brains out. Like, that people don't understand that there's more to the story, and that's why reactionary stuff is always so hilarious to me. And that's where your role really defines what goes on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, we can curse on this. Well, yeah, no, yeah. That's great.
Feel free.
You know, Scott Service isn't going to tell us which guys are available and which guys aren't before the game, unless we ask, you know, and even then he can be coy with it. You know, the best thing they can say is, well, I haven't checked with him yet. They haven't thrown yet. So I don't know which relievers are available. Well, really, you know, the guy threw four innings yesterday. I don't think he's going to be available, but they, you know, but we don't know what happened. I mean, we didn't find out Ketel Marte was scratched until, you know, 6 p.m. last night. That's just kind of how it works. So, yeah, the situations that arise in a game, why a guy is in there or not. And that's, you know, it's funny. They're like, well, I don't understand. Why are they doing this? I don't understand why they do this. I'm like, well, I don't know either. I can't, you know, go down and ask him in the dugout in the middle of the game. But it's certainly something we're going to ask. But, yeah, it's something that I didn't prepare for in journalism school.
Didn't exist when you were in journalism school.
Is that an age joke?
No, well, I'm old too.
We're
all old.
All of us in college, there were no Twitters.
Yeah, no Twitter in college.
Oh, I'd have been so much trouble.
Me too, man. God, I'm so glad that it didn't exist when I was in college and high school. I'm so happy about it. Scott, do you really quick before we let Ryan go, do you want to ask food questions? Because this is like
your thing. Yeah, you know I love food questions. It's semi-food related, but also not. First of all, do you eat the ballpark food always, or do you hold out for late meals? And what's the best place and what's the worst place?
See, this is my wheelhouse. I was actually considering doing this, doing my own separate blog called The Media Spread, where I go and just post all the pictures and places I go on the road.
Please
and
do that.
Yeah.
You know, so I read a book once that came out in like 1994 that was a guy that just did that for NBA games, and he just went out everywhere and he wrote an entire book and just went, he did every single arena in the entire season. It was the year that the Sonics were in the Coliseum. And I was like, man, I'm still upset about that. But it was a great read.
Yeah, I'll probably do that. I mean, I'm not like, you know, I hate the term foodie per se. I basically shovel in food as fast as I can get in.
Scott's a foodie. You can look. You can make fun.
I like my food.
Fine. He's
That's fine. I mean, I like it. I'm more of a working man. So I hate small portions. It drives me nuts. All right. Yeah, so this is a much debated topic among baseball writers. It's one like Aldin Gonzalez and the guys at the Angels. They had a list where you had to rate the top, you had to rate the best road trips in the AL, like on everything, city, stadium, food, everything, and you couldn't vote on your own, obviously. And Seattle was rated as probably one of the top three always. Yeah, and then for me, it's like, you know, for me, the best road trip is San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
I love San Diego, which, you know, you can – they're not going to play San Diego next year, supposedly. So that having a moment. Yeah. What?
Rivalry's dead?
Gonzaga? Really? Yeah. Are we breaking news?
That's the rumor that they're not going to play there next year, that they'll play the Rockies instead.
That's actually – I mean, that's not a bad food city either. So.
No, not yeah, but I mean it's San Diego. It's not just about food.
I know.
Yeah.
I do love your tweet pictures of your massive meals with the WAD hashtag.
Gives me workout of the day.
Gives me so much joy.
I will give Christian Capel of the News Tribune credit for that. He posted that one time on this just massive plate of teriyaki, and he had WAD there, and it made me laugh forever. but anyway, so the best press box food is probably New York, the Yankee Stadium. It's also the most expensive. You pay $13, which is fine. They have a carving station. They have three different – they always have a meat, a fish, and then a white meat of chicken or pork available. They have, like, restaurant-level chicken strips that they make, homemade chicken strips that are great. So when you're hungover in New York, which I am 95% of the time,
mm-hmm.
it's great. They have a – soft serve ice cream machine. They've got everything.
Larry Stone loves that.
Yes. So that's probably the best. The worst is Oakland, and it's not even close.
That surprises nobody.
Oakland. So here's what we do in Oakland. When we are in Oakland, Bob Dutt and I stay in downtown Oakland, and Greg John stays out by the airport. But we go to the Whole Foods in downtown Oakland, or kind of by there,
mm-hmm.
and we buy sandwiches or stuff from Whole Foods. We'll call Greg and ask him what he wants, and then we take enough for lunch and dinner to the stadium because we can't eat that. And I'm not like a – and do I strike you as a Whole Foods type of guy? No.
No, you do not.
No. Although the one down by the Seattle Times office has all the girls from Amazon in there, so that's kind of nice to go to sometimes.
You do seem like the kind of person that would be fine with that.
Yes. Yeah. But no, so that – Oakland is the worst. And the best – the worst – so like last year – we went, I was like, it was one of the first road trips. I was like, I'll give it a try again. Every year I give it one chance. And so Oakland makes the colossal mistake of going ethnic in their food.
Because
that's really what you want is white people cooking ethnic. and so we went there the first day they tried to do their interpretation of, I guess it was Chinese food. I mean, you know, as an Asian American, my mom is Japanese. I was mildly offended at their attempt. I mean, it made Panda Express look gourmet. I'm not going to lie to you. And so then the next day I was like, oh, it can't be bad. The next day they went in there and I'm not a fan of Indian food anyways. They were going to try and do Indian food. And I was like, yep, I went and got they have a pizza place in the stadium that I went and found. It's okay. But they also upped the prices this year to $12. So it's like the second most expensive medium meal. And it was like, oh, are you kidding me? San Diego is good. They have a station where they do street tacos most nights.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah. And they have a bunch of other stuff. I don't know. You're
making me wish the Mariners still had the tortas, man. Tortas were.
Yeah. Tortas were great.
Those were great. I miss them.
Yeah. What else they have? Anaheim's bad. It used to be okay, but Anaheim had like this really cool press box. It was low, like the one at Safeco. And then Artie Moreno got pissed off at the media and moved everybody out to right field. And then the media dining is really bad there too.
Screw that.
Yeah. Tampa Bay, underrated place for pretty good food.
Really?
Yeah. It's not really bad. Yeah. They do okay. I know you're stunned by this, but in Texas, nothing is healthy. Everything is fried that you eat there.
Deep fried boomstick hot dogs for the media.
Yes. Yes. It's not nothing. I left there this last week. I was just like, wow, I need to go to the gym. And I went to the gym every day and still felt like death. Trying to think what else is. We were just in Cincinnati. That was okay. And then the good thing is they didn't force Skyline Chili on us, which I think is disgusting. True. Who puts cinnamon in chili?
It's terrible.
I never.
It's a hard pass.
In the overall trips, if I'd recommend somebody, Minnesota is one of the best stadiums. It's the best downtown. It's right downtown. You can walk everywhere. They got a bunch of restaurants and bars right there. You know, it's a great setup. It's kind of a nice idea having bars and restaurants that stay open until 2 a.m.
That's weird.
By a stadium. I know it boggles people's
minds.
So
strange. So strange.
It's very foreign. You guys haven't been there yet. You got that one to look forward to.
Yeah, no, that's one of my favorites. San Diego and Minneapolis are probably two of my favorites. I would love, I'm obviously, if they don't go to San Diego next year and they go to Denver, I'll be pissed off. Because I like Denver, but I go there all the time. My sister lives there. But it's, okay. The American League West, I mean, if you're covering the American League West, that's not a bad little scenario. You got San Francisco, you've got Denver, you've got San Diego. I mean, the worst of it is probably either LA or Phoenix.
Yeah, and even Phoenix has gotten a lot better. I mean, I go down to spring training every year. Their food situation's improved a lot.
Yeah, and you can stay in Old Town Scottsdale and drive over. That's a really good setup.
Yeah, it's really nice. Scott, you have any last things for Ryan before we let him go?
Final question.
Yeah.
The worst part about an extra inning game, is it the rewrite or is it that it cuts into your post-game drinking time?
Because you cannot mix them. Never shall the two meet.
No, but I got, I have a decent-sized liquor cabinet in my apartment in Tacoma, so I can always find a way. The extra innings thing that I hate is just, deadline and writing that running game story on deadline and trying. I mean, you're still trying to give the best possible story, and you just feel like you're just putting out shit. Yeah. And then, because it's so rushed, and so you're worried about making a mistake, and nobody remembers all the words you got right, but the one mistake you made, and then you get the emails and stuff. That's what – it just kills me.
The next
How long do you have after the game, just out of curiosity?
So, that's when the game ends, I have to send a story and then go down and then come back and update it sometimes twice. and maybe I have 25 minutes. My last drop dead deadline that I have to have something in is 11:15. So some, and you know, there's a 10-minute cooling off period for the team after the game, and you get the manager, and then you know, I'm running through the halls and stuff like that, coming up and trying to make it work. It can be a little tight from time to time. And then the one thing is like, you also just, you still have to do that because we have a website too, where you got to put stuff on there. So
it's brutal. I know you guys hustle a lot. It's been a real blast having you on. The next time we have you on, I've got two segment ideas. One is that Ryan plays us angry voicemails and Ryan Divish reads your angry tweets.
And that would be a good one. I'd like that. I'm sure we could find about four or five known Twitter followers to us that we could supply all those.
I mean, not that I do mute them, but if I were going to, they would be the.
Oh, you don't know Nelson?
Oh God, he's gonna create a new Twitter account just because he's gonna listen to this and he's gonna harass us again. Ryan, we really appreciate your coverage, man, and all that you do for the team and keeping us informed, and for your time today.
No, I had a fun. Yeah, like I said, let me know if you need to do this again. And if you guys do any of those meetup things again, I'm always enjoying going up. And
we are hoping to have something later this summer. We'll make sure that you know.
Okay, sounds good.
Awesome, man. Enjoy the game tonight.
All right, see you guys.
All right, bye.
Angel of the Holy Grail saw Galahad come riding, so he took the Holy Grail off the shelf. And inside the holy chapel made for Holy Grail hiding, the angel could be seen to smile to himself. If you're the great Sir Galahad from now on, said the angel, may all angels call me blessed of my race. If you're not the great Sir Galahad, I warn you, keep on riding, and if you are, I pray you'll let me see your face. Galahad removed his helmet, said, good angel, look upon me, fear not, for I bring tidings of great joy. Along here's the grail you